Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, health, policy, and the media, and we come every week to connect the dots between all of the things that affect us, our communities, our society, and our global ecosystem from all different sectors and factors of our world. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all of that and our total health environment, talking to different thought leaders, experts, advocates, filmmakers, authers, poets, organizers, farmers, and all different people across our total spectrum. So delighted to have you with us on today's show. It's Climate Week in New York City, where this show is being recorded. And this Friday, which is September 20th, there will be a climate strike in New York. Everyone is invited to participate, to turn out and show the tremendous public awareness and demand for action on climate in the short 12-year window that remains to address it, which we've reported on extensively on this show. I'll be providing a little bit more information about that later on in the program, but just very basically, it's this Friday, September 20th. There is a people will gather at noon in Foley Square in Lower Manhattan. And then march to Battery Park, where there'll be a rally with speakers, music, and all kinds of terrific people. You can find a calendar of events for Climate Week at https://www.pcmny.org/September2019. So please do be involved. If you have children, they are forgiven for skipping school for this. And it's important that we turn out and have our voices heard. And of course, on today's show, we're doing a special on climate, looking at the regenerative agriculture, agriculture and forestry and ecology side of climate restoration, which we've covered extensively on Connect the Dots. My guest today is Seth Itzken. He is the co-founder and co-director of Soil for Climate, which is an organized group of farmers, regenerative agriculturists, scientists, advocates, and more that's involved with advocacy to really help restore our climate and at the same time provide food security to us in the coming times of disruption and change that we've kind of already will be experiencing and are experiencing, but which we're hoping to kind of keep at a manageable kind of level and also reverse if possible, which, you know, will only happen if we all advocate and get involved. So we'll be talking to Seth today about and he has a very interesting background as well as both a farmer and an organizer and a research partner, which he'll be telling us about on today's show, to provide, you know, what awaits us if we can get the right policies and programs into the public platform and the public policies for 2020. So it's my great joy to welcome to Connect the Dots, Seth Itzken. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So, how did you get involved with advocating for farmers?
Well, first, Allison, let me just say, as more of an introduction, that it really is a great honor to be on the show, and you're doing great work. And it's really just a coincidence that I'm in New York during Climate Week, and I'm really looking forward to being part of this, and it really is an honor to be part of this essential movement for humanity at this time. In regards to the specifics about soil and farmer advocacy and stuff like that, let me just back up a little bit and say, first, I was what you might call a traditional climate activist, and I put sort of traditional in quotes. People who, you know, my age, I'm in my 50s now, have been active in the climate movement for half my life, you know, since I was in my 20s, practically. And the conversation was at first simply about that this is even a problem, that there even is such a thing as a climate crisis. And then the second part of that was, well, okay, we need to move to cleaner cars and we need to change emissions. I mean, many people from my generation, we remember, you know, the very first electronic car, the very first windmill or solar panel, like when these were brand new ideas. And my colleague in the Soil for Climate organization, Carl Tiedemann, was one of the very first people involved in the electric car business. So there was a whole phase of this in the past where the conversation was simply saying, okay, climate crisis is real and we need to change the admission side of it. What's happened now is that is all still absolutely true, but what's happening now is another conversation is evolving, which I want really to bring your listeners' attention to, and that's that we also have to do drawdown. That is, we have to take the carbon that's already in the atmosphere, what's called the legacy load, out. And we advocate doing that through natural means like reforestation and regenerative agriculture and grazing. There are terms like carbon farming you've heard. We talk about soil as a sink or as a reservoir for atmospheric carbon. And it turns out that producers, land managers, farmers, ranchers, agroforestry, silver pasture, even homeowners with their gardens. It turns out that just about everyone who is interfacing with land use or land management at some level can be a climate hero on the drawdown side of the equation just by changing how you manage practices. And so we stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the reduction, reduction in emissions advocacy, moving to off of fossil fuels, absolutely 100%. But we also say we need to do land-based practices as well to draw up the legacy carbon. So I apologize for that long introduction, but that basically sets the context for our work.
No, I think that's very important. And, you know, it's really interesting because, as regular listeners know, I started out as a health and healthy nutrition and healthy agriculture advocate before realizing that we were doing so much for the sake of individual health, while on a systemic level, we were promoting through our investments an extremely harmful agricultural system that contaminated our environment and actually people's bodies and people's health as now, and we were asserting this for 20 years and, you know, or more through advocacy for organic, advocacy against GMO agriculture. And many people just thought we were flaky and nuts or something. And many other people were excluded from the organic food system because of the fact that the policies of this government subsidized unhealthy pesticide-ridden food. And therefore, the actual costs of growing organic food were made that, weren't supported as they should be, and were, much higher and therefore out of the reach of people. And so, you know, out of the reach of ordinary people. And so, therefore, there's this divide, you know, between people who are trying to eat healthy and can afford to, and those who are just kind of consigned to the toxic waste basket, and that always kind of bothered me ever more and more. And also, you know, these food choices are not just personal, they're social, they're systemic, they're environmental, because harmful food agriculture, as we've featured many speakers on this program, is actually a contributor. And so we have harmful agricultural practices that contribute to methane release. Then everybody kind of wants to just wipe that whole system out. And that system needs to be transformed so that all of the management of how we grow fruits and vegetables, nuts, and raise livestock. And, you know, there are so many things that we can do that instead of contributing to the carbon problem, as you've stated, mitigate from it. And so in my environmentalism, I then went on to cover fracking, to cover climate, to cover toxic contamination. And now it's all coming around full circle. I was at a talk at Cooper Union last night with Naomi Klein, and she said, you know, we're not as well organized as the opposition, you know, the industries, the agricultural industry, the fracking industry, all of these industries that are profiting off of this destruction and contamination, because, you know, we've been siloed in different organizing niches. And, you know, the whole point of Connect the Dots was, I'm going to cover them all, because this is a systemic problem. And yet, you know, now these groups are coming together. And I love the fact that you come from a climate background to a mitigation background and understand that, you know, we're all allies and we're all together and we can embrace all of this. And I really salute you for that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, everybody has their livelihood. Everyone has whatever niche they're kind of working on. You know, tell our listeners a little bit more about how this particular niche of basically recovery through holistic management practices is such a, you know, kind of important but underutilized intervention and potential for major transformation.
Well, Allison, thank you for that question and for going into the history. Basically, you know, I also want to say that this is a message of hope, and I'm going to answer your question in a second. But, you know, this is, I like to believe this is like the hopeful side. You know, there's so much doom and gloom, of course. But, you know, seeing land heal, like actually standing in an area that used to be degraded and see it be healthy, or even standing on a boundary of one area that's healthy and looking at the comparison of an area that's not so much, it is really hopeful. And I've personally had this experience myself. That is, I've gone to sites around the world where people are doing what's called regenerative agriculture, holistic plant grazing, carbon farming. There's lots of sort of terms for this, but basically it's restoration ecology in a way that's also producing food. And it's just really a wonderfully exciting and uplifting and hopeful experience. The reason why it's so important, so getting back to the sort of the scientific sort of underpinnings of this, is because there's already too much carbon in the atmosphere. So you see, even if we just stop the emissions today, the train has left the station, so to speak, right? The warming is already in effect. It doesn't just stop warming. In fact, research has showed it will warm for another 1,000 years, even if we just stop everything. So there are delays, and from a human's point of view, 1,000 years is a long time. But from paleoclimate, geological weather point of view, 1,000 years is nothing. So the planet is going to continue to warm, and the ice is going to continue to melt, et cetera, for generations and generations, even if we stop now, unless we complement that with an active drawdown solution. And that's why this is so important. Now, there are many drawdown solutions. I'm not saying that there's only one. But land restoration using ecology as a sink is an essential one of those drawdown solutions. And I'll say it's the most important. You know, I'll take that stand at any rate. I'll say that the ecological solutions are the most important. There are also technological solutions of trying to capture carbon, and I'm glad people are doing that and let them do it. But our advocacy is for the ecological side, so the regenerative farming, regenerative ranching, silvopasture, you know, reforestation. There's something called biochar, which is another sort of interesting methodology. So we advocate for all of that. And what the consumer can do is just try and be a little more aware of, you know, where their foods come from and how they're produced, and they can be getting fruits, vegetables, and meats that are produced regeneratively. So I want to, you know, be clear that meat is not an evil if it's produced in the right way. And there are types of grazing, like you mentioned, holistic plant grazing, which can vastly or can greatly restore soil quickly, particularly in sort of semi-arid areas where grazing was part of the evolution of grasslands and grassland soils. So it's all just about proper management, going for ecological diversity, going for soil health, this type of thing. And yes, the big guns are organizing against this. But I believe that can be overcome through smart consumers and also through even small changes in legislation, you know, putting costs on the externalities, putting a price on carbon, for example. And there is legislation that's happening now in different states around the country. We can talk more about some of that later if you want. But I believe that there are actually just a few subtle changes in the quote-unquote the system could really spearhead this revolution.
Well, and we also have the potential, you know, for maybe big changes and big support, because we do, you know, there was recently, because of the fact that the Democratic National Committee did not, in its wisdom, agree that this should be a topic at the debates for the Democratic presidential nomination that are occurring this year. There was a climate town hall in which CNN for 7 hours talked, you know, gave seven different candidates an opportunity to speak and kind of address the various issues crucial to climate. And I was present at that event in this studio audience, as were a lot of, you know, New York pro-environmentalists. And, you know, regenerative agriculture came up. You know, it's in the platform of Bernie Sanders, of Elizabeth Warren. There's several other people who've mentioned it, but they're, you know, in the top three tier candidates in the present moment as we, you know, record the show and everything. And so there's even, you know, the whole, you know, prospect of intervening in these kind of agricultural monopolies that are so intensively chemically based, they're so intensely harmful. You know, that the idea that people can just, you know, be subsidized, and not to mention, you know, not properly regulated, that some of this can perhaps be addressed through regulation, through a shift in subsidies, through demonopolization. You know, any thoughts about any of that?
Well, I mean, absolutely. We could start with ethanol. Mm-hmm. You know, you could just start right there. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of incentives that are in place to do the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And so we can get rid of ethanol. Crop insurance, the way crop insurance is mandated. I've been told, I haven't confirmed this myself, but I've been told from producers that if they do cover cropping, which is considered an essential part of healthy soil management, that they can't get crop insurance because the cover crop is considered a competitor with the crop. Hmm. They're getting the quote-unquote insurance on. I mean, that's the insanity of this situation. I mean, it's the industrial paradigm mm-hmm. applied to growing food, right? Everything is a widget that fits in a very specific place. And there's no room for diversity or changing of seasons. And it's literally a regimen. You're going to use this seed, this fertilizer, this irrigation method, this harvesting technique. They're just... The producers these days are just pawns in this big industrial system.
Mm-hmm. It's like an assembly line that you're describing. It's like an assembly line where there's no, you know, and the thing about it is an assembly line is it's a mechanistic model. I mean, you know, Charlie Chaplin so brilliantly ridiculed it way back when, Lucille Ball did, but it's like the mechanization and the breaking down of everything into a tiny little part or action to kind of rigidly systematize it. And it's, you know, it's not only lacking in creativity, but it's lacking in basic understanding that we are living, you know, living beings are not robots. We're not mechanical devices. We, you know, we're part of a system that is a living system. And I think that, you know, in the work that you do and the work that the people that you're supporting do, that is more visible, you know, to you. I mean, and it's something that unfortunately people can all too easily lose sight of, but that you get to see. I would love, you know, an experience. I'd love to hear from you a little bit more about that, because, you know, as everything gets commodified and mechanized and broken down and reduced into its tiniest part, we have to find ways. It's not just a walk in nature. It's a real shift in understanding. And I would love to know, like, tell our listeners some of your experiences of maybe how you have experienced or noticed that shift or undergone a personal change yourself, even, or have seen other people do that, from this very reductive way of thinking to this more holistic living system way of being.
Okay, well, let's just get very specific in terms of how you buy your food, mm-hmm. right? You know, there are farmer co-ops or, you know, buyer co-ops, and I just really encourage your listeners to be part of those. And, you know, we advocate for grass-fed, grass-finished, or 100% pasture-raised meats. There are co-ops that you can become part of in whatever region you're in. And you can know about the rancher, producer, who's actually producing your food. They might be a short drive from you. You can go see them. Now, I realize that it's not as convenient as just going to the market and getting what's on the shelf. But in some ways, it's more convenient. They bring it to you. You know, they show up. You need to be home or whatever. You work it out. But, I mean, this type of thing is evolving. And I have a producer. I have a home in Vermont who lives a couple towns up. And I could conceivably even ride my bike there, you know. But, you know, I could get months' worth of food, you know, if it's meats, frozen meats, and I can see the pasture that the cows are grazed on. I can see how healthy it is. We could do soil samples. You can compare that with fields just across the river, and you can see how poor those are. And you know, I'm eating a product where I really know where it came from. And that doesn't really get more basic than that, than actually knowing where your food comes from. Now, obviously, most people in the city aren't, you know, going to be on a farm aren't going to necessarily know the producer, but they can still be part of these networks, these co-op food networks. They can have the food to deliver to them, even in Manhattan. I doubt there's a major city in the country where a customer can't be part of something like that. And you could go out, you could go for a Sunday drive and visit the producers that are bringing it to you. And so I think that's really, that's from the most basic level, literally, what are you eating? That's really something that consumers can do, which would make a lot of difference. And you got to understand that these producers, they work around the clock, they work hard, and you're their lifeline. I mean, they're depending on the more educated, concerned consumer to keep their operation going. And we really need to reward these people. And yes, it costs more, but we need to pay more because they're providing an ecological service for us. You know, when they're grazing or cropping in a way that's ecologically restorative, they're providing all kinds of mitigation services to us. They're providing drought mitigation, flood mitigation, climate change mitigation, disaster mitigation. They're doing all these environmental services for us for free. And all they're asking is that we pay a little more, you know, for the meat and the vegetables. So it's a bargain. So we need to start right there by supporting the producers.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I do on Connect the Dots is that we also look at the systemic things, because I think one of the ways that we kind of lose the thread on these kinds of discussions is that we are embedded in a certain kind of business mindset where, you know, people are consumers, or if, you know, you're a health practitioner, people are patients. It's like, you know, people are people. And the people who are, and I have been one of them, able to pay the premium to eat healthy organic food, and, you know, I'm one of them. I've belonged, you know, I moved in the city into the neighborhood where I could walk to one of the largest organic food co-ops in the United States. I've been a reporter and an editor of their newspaper, and, you know, gotten that tremendous benefit of, you know, slightly reduced prices, but not everyone has access to this. So, you know, when we define the problem only in terms of people going out locally as consumers and what you're, you know, and that's the business model, what can you afford to pay? For me, in the epoch in which we're talking about the Green New Deal, we're missing a large part of the discussion. Now, I realize that in organizing farmers, who, of course, are rooted and embedded, and they're growing food in, you know, a given locality, and they're appealing to the people in that vicinity, who will, of course, get the, you know, the access to the good food with the least amount of transportation costs and shipping. So there is, you know, real, like, kind of basic bottom line entrepreneurial logic in that, as well as in environmentally sensitive logic in it. At the same time, you know, when we continue to kind of market these ideas, which are big, potentially system-changing ideas, according to that local entrepreneurial model, to me, there's a you know, we're missing an opportunity to really plug this into systemic change, because it's only going to deliver on the promise of being systemically impactful at the level that we need it. I mean, even, you know, of course, for years we've said, you know, any small thing you can do, any small step you can take, any small insight that leads down the right road, but, you know, is good. And on a human level, it is good. You know, I don't want to denigrate that at all. But we have to move more rapidly, because, you know, we've been given a deadline, and therefore we need to also think systemically about how we are going to accomplish this. Now, I threw out a question to you about, you know, the fact that presidential candidates are talking about this. They're, you know, considering ways to move the bigger ship that has been carrying us en masse in a bad direction, in order to shift course. And if that were to happen, which is obviously something I support, you know, that would also bring more people into the realm of organic food rather, and healthy food and regenerative food, rather than in an economy of economic decline, which we have right now for the majority of people outside of a particular narrow professional class that's still kind of hanging in there and hoping they'll still be okay. You know, a majority of people are excluded from that. So the appeal to the consumer, for me personally, knowing that, is basically still an appeal that is part of a dying system that is undergoing, if best case scenario, if we're going to survive, you know, a transformation. And I'd like to hear a little more from you about an answer to those systemic questions rather than appeals to, merely to consumers, although, of course, for those who have the financial wherewithal to access it, to those who are immediately in a locale where they can access the healthier food, that's great. What do you say?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, but I did want to get the consumer, you know, sort of engaged, or get the average person to believe, to understand the difference that they can make just, you know, in their shopping choices. But in terms systemically, like at the policy level, we need to stop subsidizing the deleterious practices. So, like, that's what I was trying to say before about the, you know, the ethanol mandates and, you know, the minimum prices that are guaranteed, you know, on ethanol production. It's an entirely a disastrous ecological process. You know, changing insurance policies, getting a price on carbon, for example, carbon markets. You know, this is sort of the evolving narrative. So you see, some people say, oh, well, quote unquote, don't eat meat. Well, I sort of push back against that because, well, meat's not the problem. The problem is degradation of ecosystems. And if you could be restoring ecosystems by grazing properly, then that is meat, or that's a form of production you should support. But at any rate, what can you actually measure and have the producer be rewarded for at a level of policy, not just the consumer? Well, that's soil carbon, actually measuring the carbon in the soil. And so if a producer is increasing carbon in the soil, there's only one place that carbon is coming from. It's literally coming out of the air through photosynthesis, through you know, the exudates through the roots of the plants, and they should be rewarded for that service. Okay, so that's something that has to exist at the level of policy. And these types of programs are starting to take shape. This is the type of new policy we have to have in the future, a way of rewarding producers or any type of land manager for carbon drawdown that can be verified on the ground. And so now where does the money from that come from? Well, it comes from a tax on the people who are emitting the carbon. See? So you're just moving it from one place to another, and then a lot of those people who are emitting it are actually being subsidized to do so.
That's so crazy.
You know, right, it's crazy. So you just reduce that subsidy for what's deleterious and move it toward rewarding the people that are doing the beneficial practices. And you won't need to convince a producer to stop tilling, for example, if it becomes obvious to him or her that this no-till method produces better food and requires less inputs. And, oh, by the way, they're also being rewarded for the increase in soil carbon. They don't even need to believe in climate change. And you know what? That's what's kind of cool about this in a sort of weird way, is that a lot of the producers, you know, are frankly conservative, you know, on the Republican side of the aisle. But at the end of the day, they want to do what's right for their soil and for their ecosystem and for their families and their livelihoods, and they enjoy the environment. They might enjoy hunting. You know, they have no interest in participating in degradation of land, even if they're politically conservative, even if they don't even necessarily believe in global warming. And the sort of the funny twist on all this is that they don't have to believe in it. They can do this for the reasons that just make sense to them anyway. It improves the land. It makes a better product. It reduces their risk to drought and floods. And that happens. It's a combination of both policy and also consumer demand. And that's it's almost sort of a funny little joke within our industry that some of the people who may be most instrumental in making the change may not really even personally believe in global warming, or they won't admit it in public. And we're like, you know what? That's fine. You know, that's fine. I don't care. Just do the right thing by the land. And me as an advocate and an activist, I'll get policy and consumer practices to reward you for doing the right thing.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you that what you just said is really in sync with something that Naomi Klein said last night in an interview between her and she was being interviewed by Varshini Prakash of the Sunrise Movement, which was a great kind of intergenerational conversation, really inspiring. But one of the things she said was she was talking about in her new book called On Fire. It's just literally released yesterday. She was talking about the fact that in the original New Deal, one of the things that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did was start a lot of programs, work-based programs, conservation-based tree planting programs, and a whole bunch of programs in the very neighborhoods and regions of the country who were most kind of opposed to him. He wasn't into nepotism or boondoggling, you know, in trying to restore, the country from the Great Depression. And he built up and, you know, built buildings, created jobs, and did all kinds of projects in areas of people who lived in regions, and some of them were undoubtedly rural, who, you know, did not support him and were opposed to him. And, you know, sometimes these weird dilemmas are, resolved by collaborating on something and, you know, by good works rather than by, you know, discussion and argument, you know. So although some of us like that for other reasons, but it works with some audiences in some dimensions. But she was, you know, mentioning that very pointedly in reference, I think, to, you know, rural areas and the agriculture that, you know, we're speaking of today on the show. And just, for a second with listeners, if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Seth Iskan of Soil for Climate. We're talking about regenerative agriculture and its role in reparation and recovery as part of the climate movement, and with a climate strike happening this week in New York, and also as part of a Green New Deal, which is, you know, the kind of big picture inclusive initiative that really the Sunrise Movement and others see, and Amia Klein certainly, see us as fighting for, and the kind of agriculture and the kinds of programs, you know, that you're hoping for and talking about are embedded in that. Now, and part of that. Now, I don't know. I'm going to ask you a question. Maybe I shouldn't ask this, and you can tell me if you can't discuss it. But have you done any lobbying or had any discussions with any of the political candidates about these issues and about their inclusion in public policy?
Yes, of course. And I'm happy to talk about that. We certainly Right. have. And that's a matter of public record. Mm-hmm. We've spent an hour with Bernie Sanders' staff in Burlington. These are informative sessions. They're not advocacy sessions, mm-hmm. I'll say they're informative. We've met with Bernie Sanders' staff. We just did an hour-long interview with candidate Tim Ryan that's on our Facebook page. You can see that. We've given testimony in Vermont, Connecticut, and Massachusetts for healthy soils legislations that have been pending in 2018 and 2019. And I'm very happy to say that we're seeing progress in the healthy soil legislation movement. New Mexico just signed a healthy soil legislation bill. These bills sometimes have different names. Well, obviously, they all have different names, but the one in New Mexico is called a Healthy Soils Act. Right now, you can Google New Mexico Healthy Soils Act. You'll find that one. We have a Google group called the Healthy Soils Legislation Group, or it's just called Healthy Soils Legislation. You can Google that and become part of that group. Massachusetts has a bill which has passed the Senate and the House. I don't think it's been signed into law yet, but it probably will soon. it defines healthy soils practices. So this is a movement that's happening, and we're excited about that. And yes, we are very active in that, and that's a matter of public record.
That's terrific. Of course, I mean, Vermont is a rural state. There is farming in the state. So even though, you know, Bernie speaks with a New York accent, and for many people that just, you know, his voice instantly conjures up New York City. I know this from my friends all over the country. But in fact, he has been a political leader and, you know, representing the state of Vermont, living in the state of Vermont for decades. And so, and that is a state where you country people grow stuff. So that kind of makes a lot of sense. What are your targets? Because one of the things about this whole thing is, like, you know, it's kind of like you can see the palpable difference, as you describe, between, you know, a field that has been in a terrible erosion or decline, or, you know, and then is farmed holistically and kind of comes back to life. The quality of the food is improved. You know, it holds more water. It's addressing the kind of aridification in certain regions, and, you know, more and more, and even in this country, certainly in Australia, where I have many friends and climate activist friends. So, you know, the difference that it makes could almost be shown by a snapshot as well as certain measurements. So we have that. We know that. But in terms of meeting the target of making a substantive difference with drawdown, both in our country and also hopefully as we serve as a model and as others internationally do as well, you know, everywhere, what kind of target and time frames are even possible given, you know, what we're looking at of 12 years and all of that?
I'm glad you asked that question because that's the perfect lead in to a movement. There's an international movement called 4 per 1,000. The website hashtag is 4, the letter P, and then the number 1,000, you know, or 4P1000. So if your listeners just Google on that, they'll find it, you know, immediately. But what that stands for is 4 parts per 1,000, or 0.4%. And what it refers to, so that's a very specific target. I mean, it's very specific. And what that refers to is 0.4% increase of soil organic carbon per year could allow us to reach the targets that have actually been set in the Paris Climate Accords, but the commitments that have been made by the countries won't reach those aspirational targets. And so there's something called an emissions gap. And that's the official sort of technical policy language for this. It's the gap between what people agreed to collectively in the Paris Climate Accords and what the nations actually themselves committed to, right? So collectively, everyone agreed to this target. But when you look at what all the nations are saying they'll do, it doesn't match it. So that difference is what's called the emissions gap. And the point of the 4 per 1,000 program is to fill that gap, although it's sort of filling it negatively, that is to reduce that extra load through soil carbon drawdown. And so it's 4 parts per 1,000 increasing in soil organic carbon globally would make up that difference, if you will, between what was pledged and what is aspirational. Mm. And what that works out to is 3.5 billion tons. I know this is getting kind of wonky.
Show. Don't worry
this
about it.
This is a wonky show.
Yeah.
So it's 3.5 billion tons or gigatons. So in this world, in this field, gigatons or billions, that's sort of the measurement the typical measure that people use. People talk about carbon in terms of billions of tons or gigatons. So 3.5 gigatons per year drawdown is a target through soil restoration. That's the official, I mean, you ask for a target. It doesn't get more specific and official than that. So this is policy. This is now an international program. It was spearheaded by the French government. It's called the 4 per 1,000 program, and your users, I'm sure they're looking it up right now, and good for them.
Good.
Okay, so there you go. That's a specific goal, and the organization that I'm affiliated with, Soil for Climate, we are a quote unquote civil society. That's their term for it, a civil society member of the 4 per 1,000 initiative. And by civil society, they just mean like a private nonprofit, as opposed to an institutional member or a governmental member.
Yeah, that's terrific. Thank you. That really, really kind of nails it down and connects the micro to the macros, and that's fantastic. While we're at it being wonky, I do have a question from the audience. Soil for Climate member and Facebook friend Richard Jeffries is asking, he'd love to hear you talk about the importance of repairing the water cycle with regenerative farming.
Yes, great question. Thank you for bringing that up. What's meant by that is in addition to the carbon drawdown, so in addition to actually taking carbon out of the air, nature regulates climate through what's called evapotranspiration. So the leaf, think of all the leaf surfaces on the planet. I mean, it's an unimaginable concept. It's sort of like fractal in nature, right? Just all of the surfaces of all of the leaves and grasses and trees, all of those are like little air conditioners, because every time water evaporates, it cools, right? It takes heat energy out of the system. And that cycle, these sort of small water cycles just within a certain local ecosystem, can profoundly change the temperature right there. And so most of the climate models sort of look at how carbon itself, from the greenhouse effect of carbon, affects climate. But there are also local conditions. So picture, for example, a large area that has grass, and another large area next to it that's desert. And let's say they're just sort of next to each other. Well, the CO2, the carbon in the atmosphere, is the same in both of them, right? I mean, they're both going to be at 400 parts per million or whatever. But you're going to be much cooler in the area where the grass is than in the area where the desert is, even though the radiative forcing from CO2 is the same. So these are localized cooling effects that the small water cycles, it's referred to, have. And so that's hugely, hugely, hugely important. And people feel that, you feel it immediately. I mean, you can feel the difference. We all have when we walk into a grassy area, versus a non-grassy one. The CO2 is the same, right?
Yeah, right? I mean, right? Definitely.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's I think that's what the caller is referring to there. That's a hugely important topic, and is largely overlooked. And now, the beauty of restoration ecology is that you get all of it. One price it gives you everything. You get the drawdown, you get the CO2 drawdown, and you get the localized cooling effect through the increase of evapotranspiration. You get it all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you don't mind, I know we're running short on time, and there's a couple things I want to throw out there too.
Sure.
While I still can. One is that I want to invite people to join the Soil for Climate Facebook group if people are on Facebook. And, there's a page, but there's a group, and the group is where really kind of all the activity is. We're at about 13,000 members now, and so I want to invite people to join that. Also, if people want to see a nice visual, you talked about a visual, there's a wonderful exhibit called Exposed, The Secret Life of Roots. Let me say that again. Exposed, The Secret Life of Roots. It was put on by the United States Botanical Garden. And if you go to their website, there's just a profound photograph. There's a couple of profound visuals that just really, you get it immediately when you see these pictures. And they're pictures of a cross-section of a healthy perennial grassland. And, you know, we're talking about 10 feet deep of topsoil. So soil has different profiles. There's topsoil, then there's the middle level, then there's, you know, just the clay or rock. But the topsoil is the part that's alive. You know, it's spongy. It has all the little creatures growing in it, the plant roots. We're talking 10 feet deep of topsoil. And I typically show this slide, and I say, you see, there's your carbon solution. There's your climate solution. You can see it. You can literally see it. That's why soil is dark. It's the color of organic carbon. And then, you know, fossilized carbon becomes coal, right? Mm-hmm. You can literally see the ancient atmospheric carbon locked up in organic matter, which in the case of coal has become, you know, mineral. Mm-hmm. But it used to be alive. And then when you see these cross sections of the grasslands, of the perennial grasslands, you know, it still is alive. So there's our sink. There's our reservoir. And I'll say there's our hope. And that's what Soil for Climate advocates for. We advocate for exactly that image that you'll see. If you go to, you know, the website is just usbg.gov, United States Botanical Garden.gov. And then the exhibit is called Exposed, The Secret Life of Roots. And when I just have sort of like one visual to give people, I just say, just look at that.
Cool. That's very cool. Just to tie this up, because this brings us back to the name of the group, Soil for Climate, and to kind of the very beginning of this. The idea is that we're actually, this is going to really be 101 after all we've discussed, but we're taking the carbon that we can't see that's out there in the air, and we're putting it through these management means back into the soil, where it actually is creating the substance to both be where it belongs, to grow our food, and to hold water, and to kind of help reverse what we've done by releasing all this carbon. Is that what drawdown is? Am I missing something? Because it sounds kind of basic and simple.
That's it. That's the natural drawdown solution. Mm-hmm. The term drawdown itself also means technological drawdown solutions, where they capture the CO2 at the smokestack and then they want to put it into concrete. And there are other ways of drawdown. If people are inspired to do it, that's fine. Let them do that. You know, I don't want to inhibit them from doing that. But from my point of view, that's not really where the game needs to be played in the future. It needs to be natural drawdown solutions through restoration ecology, restorative grazing, cropping, reforestation, you know, using nature. Mm-hmm. Drawdown itself is a generic term, whereas natural drawdown or restoration ecology is more specifically referring to using nature.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, that is so cool. That is really terrific. In terms of inviting our listeners to join Soil for Climate, you know, who are your members? Who will they find there joining Soil for Climate on Facebook?
You know, I have to tell you, I continue to be amazed myself. Mm-hmm. We sometimes do sort of like a live Facebook video interview with someone, and we'll start getting questions from all over the world. We've never done a formal survey, but you just use the Facebook analytics, group analytics, and you just assume it's correct. There's over 100 countries represented. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'll put out a call, say, oh, we need some group moderators, you know, in different time zones, right? Mm-hmm. People just start responding from all, everywhere, mm-hmm. you know, Australia, Africa, all over Europe. I mean, it's, oh, my God. I mean, you know, the language these days is English. And for better or worse, that's sort of like the universal language. So it's hard to know really where people are from in that regard.
Well, that's really great. I'm going to have to wrap this up right now. So, you know, listeners, do join Soil for Climate. And, you know, thank you so much for being with us on today's Connect the Dots, Seth. It's Ken. It's just been, a very far-ranging conversation, I think, that really encompasses the issue so terrifically in all its diversity. I want to remind listeners, please do join the students who will be out on strike this coming Friday, September 20th. If you're in the New York City area, please assemble at noon at Foley Square in Lower Manhattan. And then you'll be marching to Battery Park, where at 3 p.m. there's going to be a terrific rally with great speakers. If you've enjoyed the show, it'll be available in archives this afternoon. Please share it with others on social media, and all of our archive shows, and we also have a lot of interviews with a lot of regenerative agricultural farmers over the past several years on Connect the Dots. The archive can be found at connectthedots.podbean, that's bean with an N, .com. Thank you, Seth, Iskin, and all our listeners for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well, keep marching forward, standing tall with all our relations. Well, well.